I'm Jess Casavetto, executive producer of the hit Netflix documentary series, Dancing for the Devil, the 7M TikTok cult.
And I'm Clea Gray, former member of 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
And we're the host of the new podcast, Forgive Me For I Have Followed. Together, we'll be diving even deeper into the unbelievable stories behind 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
Listen to Forgive Me For I Have Followed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're just days away from our 2024 iHeartRadio Music Festival, presented by Capital One.
The biggest headliners in live music will be taking over T-Mobile Arena, Las Vegas.
Plus, some special surprises and moments you are not going to want to miss.
Stream only on Hulu.
The iHeartRadio Music Festival.
And listen on iHeartRadio.
The most anticipated live music event of the year.
This Friday and Saturday, starting at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Pacific.
Hey, I'm Gianna Prudenti.
And I'm Jemaine Jackson-Gadsden. We're the hosts of Let's Talk Offline from LinkedIn News and iHeart Podcasts.
There's a lot to figure out when you're just starting your career. That's where we come in.
Think of us as your work besties you can turn to for advice.
And if we don't know the answer, we bring in people who do, like negotiation expert Maury Teheri-Poor.
If you start thinking about negotiations as just a conversation, then I think it sort of eases us a little bit.
Listen to Let's Talk Offline on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On November 16th, 1992, a teenage couple was held up on West Washington Street in Chicago, and the young man, Shaharan Brandon, was shot dead. But the young lady said that she had not seen the shooter's face. Another witness statement raised the name Blue, the nickname of a local man named Roosevelt Miles. Soon, the female victim also identified Blue, sending Roosevelt away for 60 long years. But this is Wrongful Conviction. Wrongful Conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today we've got a Chicago story involving another gang unit detective out of Area 5, the same notorious unit as Ray Guevara and Ernest Halverson, which may give our regular listeners an inkling of what our guest today endured. Roosevelt Miles, thanks for being here and joining us today.
Well.
And along with him, Ashley Cohn from the Bongean Law Group. We appreciate you being here as well.
Of course.
So let's get right into it. Tell us about your childhood. What was it like growing up in Chicago at that time?
Family life is great. Learned a lot of skills from my father, a lot of cooking skills from my mom. Like any other kid, you know, went to school, was Boy Scout, junior police officer, just did everything that a kid does. Graduated, went to college.
But his trajectory in life was interrupted by a mix of cannabis possession charges, which most people agree should never have been a thing, and then the first of two wrongful convictions when he was about 23 years old and charged for the actions of a juvenile family friend.
I was with a young man and a young lady. I've been knowing a young man. His family's like family to me. They was like 16, 17, so he couldn't drive. So his mom gave me the car to take him to the store. And they went to the mall, and we was all in there. I was doing something else. And so when I went looking for him, and J.C. Penney, they said, I know I got bum rushed by the police. So apparently they had picked him and her up from using a fraudulent credit card, and they charged me with it.
So they stuck Roosevelt with this forgery charge rather than bothering with the two juveniles.
But Dowry was on probation for marijuana offenses. Then my lawyer say, well, you got this other case, so you need to cop out. And I copped out, which I should never, because that wasn't my case. And I did 18 months.
These are the wrongful convictions that we rarely ever even hear about, but they're probably the most prevalent, where people just plead guilty and take a short sentence as a matter of being practical. They're avoiding the risk of losing a trial and multiplying the length of their sentence
So after 18 months, Roosevelt paroled out, and he began working for the Chicago Parks District, but his record kept him on the radar of police in November of 1992.
So on November 16th, 1992, a 16-year-old by the name of Shaharan Brandon, who goes by the nickname Tony, was with his girlfriend, Octavius Morris, who is nicknamed Tweety. She was 15 years old at the time. And the two of them were at her mother's house on the 4800 block of West Washington Boulevard in Chicago, Illinois. And they decided at 2:30 in the morning that they wanted to go get something to eat. Once outside, according to Morris, a gunman came up, said, "This is a stick up," and fired several shots at Tony. She actually ran and she came back to the scene. Then police came and speak to any witnesses. Okay, so Octavia says that there were two shooters. One, a teenage boy wearing all black clothing, that he was 6 feet tall. And she also says that she didn't see his face. And she said that she had seen another individual underneath the porch. And she also described him as a teenager.
She said it was a dark-skinned young man, 5 feet 8, 5 feet 9, teenager.
Then there was another witness. She was a sex worker and she was down the block. And she says that she only saw one shooter, but both had described the shooter as teenager, 6 feet tall. So those facts remained consistent.
So the description of these individuals never fit me at all, age or nothing. She said 15 to 16, young men. I was 28, so it could never match me.
And that was more solidly confirmed shortly after the shooting.
The original reports say that there were many individuals in the area on the scene. So Roosevelt, he lived in the neighborhood. So he is picked up by two officers and taken over to the scene.
Well, they didn't force me to walk. They just walked with me over to the police cars that was parked at the crime scene. And so when we got over there, they stood me by a car and the witness in the car said it wasn't me.
Octavius and Sandra Birch, who is the sex worker down the street. They both knew him from the neighborhood and they both knew him as Blue. And they both tell the police, no, that wasn't him. I know, we know who that is. That's Blue. He was not the shooter. Okay. And the cops let him go.
The two witnesses agreed that it wasn't Roosevelt, who they knew as Blue, but they did agree on the description of at least one of the shooters, a 6 foot tall teenager wearing dark clothing. But the investigation goes off the rails as Sandra Birch, with the trappings of her line of work, was vulnerable to coercion. And then Octavius also had a vulnerability. After all, remember, it's a little odd that despite her vantage point, she claimed that she had not seen the shooter's face.
They assume that Tweety knew more than she let on. It was actually the victim's family who brought it to the attention of the cops, and they thought that she may have known who the shooter was, a former boyfriend. So there were some cops that were looking into that lead. But at some point, we see a very well-known, disgraced officer, Anthony Wojcik, and his lackeys, Rutherford and McDonald. Once Wojcik gets involved, there was some transformation in the reports that instead of Sandra Birch saying, "I saw Blue at the scene and told the officers it wasn't him," it turned into, "I saw Blue standing over the body at the time of the murder."
Simultaneously, it appears Wojcik turned up the pressure on Octavius.
They went to her house multiple times and kept saying, "We know it was Blue. Just say it was Blue." And eventually she capitulated and she said it was Blue. I mean, she's 15 years old. She's scared. The cops keep coming to her house. She does not have a clean background. She was part of a gang herself. She had a history of some criminal misconduct. And so they used that to basically persuade her and Sandra Birch to testify before the grand jury so that they have them under oath. And then if they change their story, they can threaten them with perjury.
And with both of their statements, they arrest the same man who both witnesses had cleared at the crime scene.
They brought me to the police station. They took me upstairs on the second floor into an interrogation room. And they immediately handcuffed me to the bench. I was beaten by Detective Anthony Wojcik with a telephone book and a mag light. To say I'd done something I didn't do, I was choked. And this process went on without being able to use the washroom or eat for 2 days. And at one point I started crying, "You can kill me because I'm not going to say nothing that I didn't do." I didn't allow them to be the confession of me.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
We're just days away from our 2024 iHeartRadio Music Festival, presented by Capital One.
The biggest headliners in live music will be taking over T-Mobile Arena, Las Vegas.
Plus, some special surprises and moments you are not going to want to miss.
Stream only on Hulu.
The iHeartRadio Music Festival.
And listen on iHeartRadio.
The most anticipated live music event of the year.
This Friday and Saturday, starting at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Pacific.
I'm Jess Acevedo, executive producer of the hit Netflix documentary series Dancing for the Devil, the 7M TikTok cult.
And I'm Clea Gray, former member of 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
And we're the host of the new podcast, Forgive Me for I Have Followed. Together, we'll be diving even deeper into the unbelievable stories behind 7M Films and LA-based Shekinah Church, an alleged cult that has impacted members for over two decades.
Jessica and I will delve into the hidden truths between high control groups and interview dancers, church members, and others whose lives and careers have been impacted, just like mine.
Through powerful, in-depth interviews with former members and new, chilling firsthand accounts, the series will illuminate untold and extremely necessary perspectives. Forgive Me for I Have Followed will be more than an exploration. It's a vital revelation aimed at ensuring these types of abuses never happen again.
Listen to Forgive Me for I Have Followed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In a galaxy far, far away.
No, babe, that's Taken. We're in our own world, remember?
Right. In our own world, we're two space cadets.
And totally normal humans.
Sure, totally normal humans.
Embark on a journey across the stars, discovering the wonders of the universe one episode at a time.
We'll talk about life, love, laughter, and why you should never argue with your co-pilot.
Especially when she's always right.
Right. And if we hit turbulence, just blame it on Mercury retrograde.
Or Emily's questionable space piloting skills.
Hey, join us on In Our Own World for cosmic conversations, stellar laughs,
and super corny dad jokes.
Listen to In Our Own World as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't worry, we promise to avoid any black holes.
Most of the time.
I don't believe we've ever heard of someone walking out of the Chicago interrogation room, which is really a torture room, let's call it what it is, having held on to their truth. It's remarkable, really. But nevertheless, they still had two witness statements, never mind how far their testimony departed from their original statements, but yet it still took all the way until January of 1996 to take Roosevelt to trial.
There's reasons for why it was taking that long.
Yeah.
So one thing that happened is we know Sandra Birch, she had died. Another thing that happened, Roosevelt's public defenders go to see Tweedy and she provides a handwritten and a typewritten statement to their investigators, basically saying, the police kept coming to my house and telling me to say that Blue is the one who did it. And the only reason I said that it was Blue is because they were forcing me to do it. And I don't know who the shooter was, but it was not Blue. So they're scrambling to figure out their case, which is why continuance after continuance, they're figuring out what they can do. And what we see in the file is the victim's family member comes into the police station and says, my wife was out and was talking to a woman by the name of Deborah Lenore, who said she was with Roosevelt on the night of the shooting with her brother at the Dragon's Den. So Roosevelt, he actually was like a block and a half away when the shooting happened. He heard the shots. He was coming out of a friend of his house and he saw a buddy of his, Michael Hooker. And then he went to the Dragon's Den later that night.
Yes, a motorcycle club, MC. They have pool tournaments. I shoot pool. And on Sunday nights, it's pool tournament time.
According to statements from Deborah Lenore and her brother Oliver in 1993, they did see Roosevelt that night when he was at the motorcycle club hours after the shooting.
But then in 1995, 2 years later, all of a sudden there's this whole circumstantial story where he ran up to Deborah and Oliver after the shots, and it kind of just seemed a little sketchy that he was running out from where the shootings came from, and that ultimately ends up being the story that goes to trial. And I mean, even according to Tweedy, from what we know now, Deborah Lenore, who's also now deceased, she had a drug problem, was apparently being provided some drugs by the cops. At least that's what Tweedy had mentioned to us. And so they take these individuals who are susceptible to coercion and they mold these stories into something that they want to tell to a jury that they think is sufficient to convict an innocent person like Roosevelt.
After more than 3 long years in Cook County Jail, the trial finally began in January 1996. And by this time, the state's attorneys, Milkovich and Lynch, along with the locked grand jury testimony and a threat of perjury, had Octavius back on her coerced story again.
She flips back and she says the reason she says it wasn't Blue is because she was scared that he was going to do something to her. So that's her reason for initially not saying that it was him, then saying that it was him, then saying that it wasn't him, and now testifying that it was him. So she testifies and the jury hears that she provided a statement to the investigators, and it's messy. There are 2 cops that testify. One basically says, no, we only went to Octavius Morris's house once. We didn't go there 5 to 6 times. And then one officer testifies that after they interviewed a witness, they went looking for Blue.
So the 2 officers' testimony served to both clear up the messiness around Octavius Morris's recantation and gave the appearance that the suspicion of Roosevelt had come from an independent source.
So the judge didn't let in that there was this witness, Sandra Birch, but there's an exception where it's like the course of the investigation. So, you know, it makes it seem like there was a witness who identified Blue, and that's what made them go look for him.
And without her there, or even naming her, there was no way to impeach that evidence. Perhaps raising how she hadn't identified Roosevelt at the show-up and what made her change her version of events. And then there was a garbled and nonsensical circumstantial evidence from Deborah Lenore and her brother Oliver.
Oliver had passed away, actually, at that point as well. So Deborah just testifies that basically the story of her walking down the street and Roosevelt just comes running up behind her and it's around the time of the shooting and that's it. It's so far-fetched. But these pieces being put together, apparently back in 96, was sufficient for a jury to convict him.
I walked in thinking I was going to get a fair trial, thinking the lawyer that I had, Mr. Even, would represent me to the fullest. And when I sit down and heard the testimony, he barely objected to a lot of these what was brought out, especially things dealing with a dead prostitute that shouldn't have never been brought out. But they allowed the jury to hear this. Halfway through, I say, I knew I'm going to prison. If the jury would have knew how this all played out, the scenario of this whole case, I would have never been found guilty. But I didn't have that representation to do that.
One thing about Roosevelt's public defender, he did try to get in a lot of things that the judge just would not allow him to get into. There were early on statements about the potential third-party offender who was Octavius's former boyfriend, but he didn't do the work of really trying to explore that as much as he should have. And because he couldn't give the judge enough of a proffer related to that, he barred it from coming in.
In addition, Roosevelt's attorney could have called his alibi witness, Michael Hooker. So that left Octavius Morris's fabricated identification and the circumstantial support. And somehow that was enough to send Roosevelt away for 60 years.
So when they found me guilty, I just stood there in shock. You know, I just stood there in shock. The day I got sentenced, I asked Judge Porter, can I see my parents? He denied me. Told me they could pass me drugs. Why would you say that? These are elderly people. These are my mom and dad. So that was the last time I saw my mom. And she passed away while I was in prison. And she didn't ever come see me because I didn't want to come see me. And that was the last time I saw her. It was in trial.
We're just days away from our 2024 iHeartRadio Music Festival, presented by Capital One.
The biggest headliners in live music will be taking over T-Mobile Arena Las Vegas.
Plus, some special surprises and moments you are not going to want to miss.
Stream only on Hulu.
The iHeartRadio Music Festival.
And listen on iHeartRadio.
The most anticipated live music event of the year.
This Friday and Saturday, starting at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Pacific.
I'm Jessica Acevedo, executive producer of the hit Netflix documentary series, Dancing for the Devil, the 7M TikTok cult.
And I'm Clea Gray, former member of 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
And we're the host of the new podcast, Forgive Me For I Have Followed. Together, we'll be diving even deeper into the unbelievable stories behind 7M Films and LA-based Shekinah Church, an alleged cult that has impacted members for over two decades.
Jessica and I will delve into the hidden truths between high-control groups and interview dancers, church members, and others whose lives and careers have been impacted, just like mine.
Through powerful, in-depth interviews with former members and new, chilling firsthand accounts, the series will illuminate untold and extremely necessary perspectives. Forgive Me For I Have Followed will be more than an exploration. It's a vital revelation aimed at ensuring these types of abuses never happen again.
Listen to Forgive Me For I Have Followed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you ever wonder where your favorite foods come from?
Like, what's the history behind bacon-wrapped hot dogs?
Hi, I'm Eva Longoria.
Hi, I'm Maite Gomez-Rejon.
Our podcast, Hungry for History, is back.
Season two. Are we recording? Are we good?
Oh, we push record, right?
Okay. And this season, we're taking an even bigger bite
out of the most delicious food and its history.
Saying that the most popular cocktail is the margarita, followed by the mojito from Cuba and the piña colada from Puerto Rico.
We thank Latin culture.
There's a mention of blood sausage in Homer's Odyssey that dates back to the 9th century B.C.
B.C.?
I didn't realize how old the hot dog was.
Listen to Hungry for History as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Being shipped to Stateville was a whole different avenue. You ever been in a place and you just numb? I felt numb. And I got in a cell with a guy I know. He was a little guy from the neighborhood. Come to find out, his aunties was my neighbors. I didn't even know that until we got talking. But I felt somewhere okay. But you never okay. My life is never the same, you know. And just one night, I'm in a cell. My cellie at work, about 2 in the morning, storming. And my next-door neighbor killed his cellie. That's trauma, man. Being a grown man hollering and screaming, that's trauma. And I'm in here for something I ain't do. I can honestly say that. Most of the staff was very supportive of my innocence. Because if you didn't see me at work, I was in a law library. If I wasn't in a law library, I was on a visit. I barely went to the yard. And that's how I gave my bit. You know, my days was spent researching. And Ashley would tell you, I did so much work. I ran through 3 typewriters, you know, because I knew I was innocent. You know, the innocent fight for life. The guilty fight for a short period. I'm still fighting.
After the boilerplate denials on direct appeal, Roosevelt did his post-conviction filings pro se, meaning on his own, without an attorney. And that began with an affidavit from Michael Hooker, who had not only been with him, but had also seen him come out of his house after the shooting had already occurred.
Michael Hooker was an alibi witness that Roosevelt had told the public defender about at the time, and he didn't call him at trial. He didn't get his affidavit and he didn't get his testimony.
Yes, I ineffective assistance counsel for failure called my alibi witness. It was denied and I appealed it. And the decision came back December 2000. And once I read it, I said, I'm going home.
Ultimately, Roosevelt was granted a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, after he did provide a affidavit from Michael Hooker, basically saying that he was with him on the night when they heard the shots were fired.
But
I waited 18 years for this hearing.
The judge just basically allows it to languish. So he is tossed around from public defender to public defender. He has one public defender who is actually doing really good work for him, but unfortunately, he also died. The amount of people who have died in Roosevelt's case is actually insane. But another one takes over and just sits and it sits and sits. And finally, in 2017, Roosevelt finds us, the Bongean Law Group. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was new from out of law school. I get this massive file from the public defender's office that was 15,000 pages. And part of our responsibility as post-conviction attorneys is we have to find new evidence, right? So we make efforts to go to Octavius's house multiple times. It seems like we weren't the only ones. The state was also trying to talk to her. At that time, there was a new conviction integrity unit at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. And we wrote to them, said, this case is so weak. There's no evidence. There's just this one recanted eyewitness identification that is not even legitimate because she says she didn't see the shooter's face in the beginning. And why are you sticking to this? So we thought we would maybe get play there. We didn't. And we kept striking out with Octavius. And then all of a sudden, one day she decided to call our office. And she said, I told the police I knew who Blue was and I knew it was not Blue. And she says, I remember the guy, the officer's name, because it was my brother's name. And my brother's name was Tony. And Tony kept coming to my house and saying, this is the person who did it. And if you don't testify, then we're going to say that you were involved in the shooting and you knew who did it or you had some responsibility. So you have to testify and say that it was Roosevelt. End of story. Done deal. So ultimately, she does.
And of course, Tony was Detective Anthony Wojcik. Octavius Morris later swore an affidavit to exactly what she had said over the phone, exactly as she had said it when she recanted all those years ago to Roosevelt's trial attorney. And so Ashley amended Roosevelt's 2000 filing with this affidavit.
And one of the biggest things in our post-conviction petition that we had filed, a lot of the new evidence was related to Anthony Wojcik's pattern and practice of misconduct that has come to light over the years. Anthony Wojcik rose the ranks through his 30 years at the Chicago Police Department with little to no supervision or discipline. There were scores of allegations and findings of misconduct against Wojcik.
So I did a FOIA request and somebody gave me Anthony Wojcik police complaint history, which they don't do. And I found out that he had 43 complaints against him.
Early on in Wojcik's career, he was criminally prosecuted for beating up a man who was found in bed with some female lover of his, and the case was dismissed. That was the beginning of his career, and he still rose the ranks. He went police officer, detective, sergeant, lieutenant. Like, they did nothing about this problem officer all these years. And the Exoneration Project in Chicago, you know, Carl Leonard and David Owens, they did a lot of legwork getting Wojcik pattern and practice witnesses. And during one of our post-conviction hearings for two other individuals, Kane and Abrego, who were victims of Detective Wojcik, we put on, I want to say, 14 different witnesses, former police officers to public defenders to inmates who provided compelling evidence of misconduct throughout his career. And he was untouchable. And he used that to coerce confessions, manipulate witnesses, to frame innocent people, and he got away with it. Detective Wojcik eventually retired in May 2016 after the Office of the Inspector General found that he had committed a litany of violations, including making false reports during the investigation of the events that led up to Laquan McDonald's shooting.
In case you don't remember, Laquan McDonald was a 17-year-old kid who was alleged to have been walking down the street in Chicago wielding a knife and was shot by Officer Jason Van Dyke after he allegedly refused to drop the weapon. And the police reports from multiple officers were pretty much identical as to what had happened.
So Wojcik was the supervising lieutenant in this case, but he got a call from up higher and the call was told him, I got that in writing, Tony, can you make this case go away? How you make a case go away? You a lieutenant. You investigate cases.
After Laquan McDonald was shot, Anthony Wojcik basically helped officers make a bunch of reports.
And he wrote that this was justifiable homicide.
But then video emerged showing that Laquan had been murdered. Let's call it what it is. Shot 16 times, despite having complied with Officer Van Dyke's order. And he was not a threat. In fact, when he was killed, he was walking away.
And everybody say that just one apple in the barrel is just right. No, the barrel is rotten.
And so with Octavius Morris's affidavit, supported by Wojcik's pattern and practice evidence, Ashley, along with Jennifer Bongean, finally was able to get him back into court in 2018.
And they gave me the hearing. Remember, I said 18 years, right? It took the judge less than 5 minutes to deny my post-conviction.
Roosevelt's trial judge from 1996, Judge Porter, after waiting 18 years to follow through on the hearing he granted back in 2000, dismissed the ineffective assistance of counsel claim as untimely. Yeah, so while I try to compose myself and get my shit together off mic, Roosevelt can tell us about how, instead of the justice he deserved, he was paroled out after 28 years of his 60-year sentence.
I got paroled 2 years short of 30 years because of good conduct credit. I received my paralegal certificate in Stateville, that county. I worked 21 years in correctional industry. So I got good time for that. So I was released 2 years early. But the same time that I was released, an appellate court decision that came down stating that I get an evidentiary hearing.
Once we get back to Porter. Judge Porter recuses himself. We go to a second judge, Judge Raines. Judge Raines, there's a whole other story there that involves Jenny and Judge Raines being caught on a hot mic.
Judge Raines was on a Zoom call that he thought had ended. And he said something about Jennifer Bongean to the effect of, man, can you imagine waking up to her every morning? Now, I find Ms. Bongean to be a particularly wonderful individual. So I'm not sure what this guy's problem was, but either way, those Zoom calls were recorded and they got leaked.
And it went viral.
He ends up not only recusing himself, but having to go to judge jail. So then finally we find ourselves in front of Judge Howard. And she presided over Kane and Abrego's evidentiary hearing. So she had been a little familiar with Anthony Wojcik and all the pattern and practice. And we get ready to go to our hearing December 5th, 2022. He was locked up December 7th in 1992. Mm. It was almost to the day. Octavius Morris shows up. We're all ready to go. And the state's attorney, Todd Dombrowski, says that they're going to agree to post-conviction relief and dismiss the charges and vacated his conviction.
So I came home in 2020, and 2022, I was exonerated. 2024, I got my certificate of innocence.
You have to affirmatively prove that you're actually innocent, which by statute in Illinois, if you are actually innocent, you could be entitled to compensation. I think it maxes out around $255,000, $275,000. And we're like, great, they're not going to intervene in this. The state's not going to take a position because they vacated his charges. But lo and behold, they did.
This decision really struck me as strange. The current office has done really great work and has been very transparent in acknowledging the city's dark past and those responsible for it, many of whom have been repeatedly profiled here. John Burge and the Midnight Crew, Detectives Guevara and Halverson. But despite the condemning evidence against Anthony Wojcik, they'd go so far as to try to leave Roosevelt in limbo, charges dismissed, but not willing to admit to and endorse his innocence as they clearly should.
Wojcik is a very big problem for the city of Chicago, but for some reason, and I'm noticing a lot, like the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, while they're willing to admit that Guevara was a bad officer, they are not willing to admit that Wojcik was a bad officer. They will do whatever to protect that man. And when that happens, it seems to me that there has to be some other reason why there's some political, something going on that suggests that there's a reason to protect him.
But eventually, there's a little light at the end of this long, miserable tunnel.
July 31st, we went to a five-hour contentious hearing arguing the state was trying to say that he can't affirmatively prove his innocence. And the judge, same day, said this case had slim evidence to begin with, and there is no evidence to rebut what Roosevelt is saying. So he gets his certificate of innocence. End of story.
I wish you all the best in the civil litigation. Roosevelt, there's no amount that they could ever give you that would make up for this. But in the meantime, is there anything that you'd like, any action steps that you'd like our audience to take?
I want to tell the audience, you know, I'm doing good. I have a nonprofit organization in Peoria called Help Break the Chain. I've doctored a school where I go in. I do one-on-ones with students and small groups. And I try to better myself each and every day. God wakes me up and give me life. Everything after that, I give back to him. So I'm not bitter. I just hate that I lost my parents 7 months apart in 16 and 17. But I know they watches over me every move, every step I make. And I'm just happy to have my earth angels in my corner, Ashley and Jennifer. These young ladies brought me out of hell, out of pit of fire, and brought me to life, gave me life back, as they do with so many others. We're family. That's all I can say. We're family. And I just like to see Wojcik have his day in court where everybody sees his true colors and who this man really is.
Amen to that. And we're going to have your nonprofit linked in the episode description. So for anyone who wants to get involved, please check it out. And with that, we go now to closing arguments where, first of all, I thank both of you again for sharing this unbelievable story. I'm going to kick back in my chair with my microphone off and my headphones on and just listen to anything else you want to share. Ashley, you go first. And then Roosevelt, you take us off into the sunset.
For the sixth year in a row, Chicago ranked the first in the number of exonerations across the United States. They are the wrongful conviction capital of the world. They've paid over $735 million in connection with lawsuits for wrongful convictions. The number does not consider the attorney's fees and the cost paid to private firms to defend these unwinnable cases. And there's over 200 wrongful conviction cases currently pending in the Northern District of Illinois right now. There were issues back in the 90s, in the 80s, that really hurt a lot of people. And it should trigger something in the city of Chicago to say, you know what, we really need to evaluate these cases. We need to look at these individuals, assess their cases early on, and provide compensation. I mean, Roosevelt's 60 years old. He doesn't want to spend the next 7 years fighting in court. He'd be open to a reasonable settlement amount for what he went through, because we all know there is absolutely no amount of money that can compensate somebody for a wrongful conviction. Give them the opportunity to rebuild their life and to start anew and fairly. And then maybe you'll save some money. Maybe don't think about, you know, oh, how it's going to hurt your pocket now. Think about down the road. It's going to hurt a lot more when the city goes bankrupt because they have 2,200 wrongful conviction cases that they have to pay out astronomical money and also to attorney's fees. It's just, it's so short-sighted, and there really needs to be somebody who comes in, who looks at these cases for what they are early on and figures out how to settle them in a way that makes the individual on the other side happy enough to move on with their life. It's a real problem, and I really hope somebody can figure this out for all of them.
All right, I'd like to thank Lava and you guys for doing what y'all do. It helps show America what Chicago is really about when it comes to these wrongful convictions. We need to take the whole justice system in Illinois and get it redone. Need a do-over, just like you do a makeover, need a do-over. I wrote DOJ about this years ago, and they wrote me back and said they're going to work on it. Yet it still hasn't happened, but now one of the former lawyers on my case is working to change it. We need change, because if we don't, it's going to be a whole lot of payment coming. And it's a lot of people that's in prison for wrongful conviction, not counting the people that didn't even fight it and came home from these wrongful convictions. You know, I know a lot of them that gave up. So I just want us to be back right, right? Society back right, man. You know, we need to let the legislators in Illinois sit down and go to work on it. Because it's a bill out now where they'll pay me $0.5 million for my CFI. All you gotta do is sign that bill. Quit sitting on it. But I'm here. I'm here to testify that God is good. People are good. And I know that our legislators got some type of good in their heart where they see this. Because my case should never happen. And it should never linger in court for 22 years like it done.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Hey, I'm Gianna Prudenti.
And I'm Jamaica Jackson Gadsden. We're the hosts of Let's Talk Offline from LinkedIn News and iHeart Podcasts.
There's a lot to figure out when you're just starting your career. That's where we come in.
Think of us as your work besties you can turn to for advice.
And if we don't know the answer, we bring in people who do, like negotiation expert Maury Tahiri-Poor.
If you start thinking about negotiations as just a conversation, then I think it sort of eases us a little bit.
Listen to Let's Talk Offline on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're just days away from our 2024 iHeartRadio Music Festival, presented by Capital One.
The biggest headliners in live music will be taking over T-Mobile Arena, Las Vegas.
Plus, some special surprises and moments you are not going to want to miss.
Stream only on Hulu.
The iHeartRadio Music Festival.
And listen on iHeartRadio.
The most anticipated live music event of the year.
This Friday and Saturday, starting at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 Pacific.
I'm Jessica Acevedo, executive producer of the hit Netflix documentary series Dancing for the Devil, the 7M TikTok cult.
And I'm Clea Gray, former member of 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
And we're the host of the new podcast, Forgive Me for I Have Followed. Together, we'll be diving even deeper into the unbelievable stories behind 7M Films and Shekinah Church.
Listen to Forgive Me for I Have Followed on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.